many times to Calgary, say from McLeod. I've flown over to Medicine Hat, to the big service flying station there. I wanted to get to a wedding one weekend, and I said I needed one to get to Moose Jaw, and so it was arranged that they did a navigational triangle, mm-hmm. and they flew to Medicine Hat, and from there to Maple Creek, or no, the next town. Swift Current, mm-hmm. and they got me as far as Swift Current, and I was dropped off at the an RAF station there. Mm-hmm. The RAF station, they were quite a bit more loosely run than the RCAF station.
Isn't that right? I find that a little bit surprising.
They were pretty casual. it was getting evening when I was there, and I spoke to the chief flying officer, chief flying instructor. He said, "You would like to get you over to Moose Jaw." But he said, "I don't know that anybody around here that's checked out for night flying." and a pilot standing there, a big slit down his pants. I thought it was kind of remarkable. He said, "I'll take the MO over to. I'm pretty good at night flying." So we got in a bowling broke. In a bowling boat, you can see everything below you. Mm-hmm. They've got a big plastic nose. And they weren't using the runway, they were doing some repairs to the runway, so he just struck off. He just struck off across the open field in this bowling broke, a big two-engine plane. I got there fine. And
got nerves a little bit worse for wear, no doubt.
Yes, you got paid for it. Mm-hmm. I would get paid for flying for a couple of days for that. It wasn't very much.
You would get dry extra pay for so many hours flown and whatnot.
Yeah, so yeah. This had to be reported in the daily routine orders that Flight Lieutenant McNeil made a trip to so-and-so.
Did, as you mentioned, the reason for being encouraged to fly for the medical people was so that they could learn as much about aircraft and related problems. Did that did those experiences include hands-on flight? Were you allowed to take over the actual control of the plane from time to time?
Yes, the pilots and we came to know many of the pilots on the station, many of the training pilots. Mm-hmm. So we commonly knew the man personally that we flew with. So he might very well ask you if you'd like to try. I remember him one cutting off a motor. It certainly made the plane act unusual, as far as I was concerned. He just cut this motor out, and I hadn't noticed it. He started it again, and we flew straight and level. But there was opportunities, and sometimes there was a little fooling around too. You might do a little low flying, or you might do some aerobatics.
Overall, though, made you glad to be in a position on the ground, though. It didn't reinforce any desire to become a pilot, I don't imagine.
Well, I was getting on then. I wasn't thinking about flying then.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned also before that the base was subject to the Chinook winds, which are fairly prevalent to that area of Alberta, and they cause certain difficulties for the aircraft, and I'm just wondering if you could expand on those.
Well, that area of southern Alberta is very dry. These warm winds coming from the west pass over the prairie. Mm-hmm. It's part of the basis of the ranching industry in Alberta that the land is kept free of snow and cattle can remain out all winter. Mm-hmm. But it was particularly suitable for flying. These winds were steady from the west, but they were very strong, so that the airspeed might indicate 60 or 80 miles an hour as he landed or took off, but really he was not moving that fast at all. Sometimes on landing he almost seemed to be
stalled.
In midair, just stopped. And mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Did that ever, did the Chinooks ever precipitate any mishaps, such as crashes and whatnot?
Yes, we had we had at least on one occasion one plane landing on top of another.
Mm-hmm.
Just piggybacked to have pictures of such.
Good war memento. You yourself finally do make it to Europe in July 1944, and just before we get into that, you had a little story about the fact that you almost didn't make it to Europe. There was a problem there, and maybe you'd like to just recount that.
I have forgotten that letter. Can you remind me? Yes, I think I was saying to you, Rick, that with this great large Commonwealth training plan, the requirements for ground crew were great, and particularly medical officers, so that the RCAF had a large number of Air Force medical officers.
Mm-hmm.
But not too many of these people got overseas. And so I was most fortunate to have done so.
Mm-hmm.
It was a short while before I was posted overseas that we were visited by the director DMS Air, the Director of Medical Services Air.
Mm-hmm.
We had a little crash on the plane, on the tarmac that day, and I attended it. And whether this influenced him to post me or not, I often wondered.
Mm-hmm. You were, of course, posted to England via Lachine, Quebec, where you embarked on a train for Halifax. And once in Halifax, you were transported via the liner Mauritania. And I'm just wondering, that would have been about approximately a 5 or 6 day voyage, I guess, to England. What were the conditions aboard the ship? I mean, we must be talking about several thousand men on board of a ship, and from a medical point of view, obviously the potential for unsanitary conditions is fairly high. What were, to the best of your recollection, what were the conditions on the ship, and did you have any shipboard duties?
Yes, this was a beautiful, beautiful liner,
mm-hmm.
not very old at all, but it had been altered or changed to accommodate troops,
mm-hmm.
and there were, I would think, 5,000 troops on them.
Mm-hmm.
There were anti-aircraft guns on the ship, fore and aft. I remember those anti-aircraft guns were handled or manned by Americans, remarkably.
Is that right?
You were allowed out on the deck during the day, but at night you were confined inside. It was at night that things seemed to be most
mm-hmm.
gloomy. I had occasion to go down to C, D, E decks, and there were hundreds of men of all services. Their accommodation was truly the this was my first real experience of war deprivations, that areas to sleep,
sardines in a can,
no area to move around. There were no facilities for anything but to just live there.
Mm-hmm.
Food was brought around in milk or cream can types of things,
mm-hmm.
and ladled out into the plate that the guy had in his hand. Most of us had duties, and I was, shortly after I got on the ship, I attended the medical officer in charge of the ship. His department, his quarters,
mm-hmm.
and I was assigned to the infirmary, to the ship's hospital, and for the whole of that voyage, I was essentially in charge of all the people that were admitted to that.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked after Army, Air Force people. They were commonly infections that developed during that time. Streptococcal infections, which are not too important now. they're cleared up as quickly as they appear. Terrible throats and
flu viruses and things like that.
Yes, infectious diseases. There was some very severe seasickness.
Mm-hmm.
Some people were. I can remember the nursing sisters on the ship were quite unsympathetic about a person with that seasickness.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't ever have it, but I would feel some empathy for the symptoms that such a fellow would have under conditions like that.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, I guess the main worry that everybody would have, of course, would be from the U-boat threat and whatnot. Can you recall your feelings during, you know, the odd hours when you were not perhaps in sick bay? Did you get a chance to wander around up on the deck at all, and sort of examine your feelings, you know, as you're...
Yes, we walked around. We had some time to walk around the ship during the day. The loudspeakers are on quite regularly, and there are you follow very definite directions on how you act.
Mm-hmm.
The captain of the ship spoke to us, and he spoke to us in very serious, no uncertain terms as to how we deport ourselves, how we should act. We will do exactly as we were told.
Mm-hmm.
And I think perhaps I mentioned to you being on deck when you were mustered there. You were mustered to a squad or a division such as you see a lifeboat drill now. You were given very definite directions on what you did and how you acted. An army officer objected and refused to do something as directed by the man in charge of that platoon, he wasn't going to accept the instructions of a non-commissioned officer,
mm-hmm.
and he himself being a captain, I presume. Actually, the captain was, if not court-martialed, he was charged and got in some difficulty about it, I'm just trying to indicate that the discipline was strict.
Sure, I guess out of necessity, of course. After the voyage, you docked in Liverpool and were transported by train to RAF Gloucester, which is a staging area for both the RAF and the RCAF. Stayed there for a couple of days and then were transferred to another staging area in London. And I guess by the time you got to London, you really sort of saw the results of aerial bombardment and whatnot. How was your reaction to the wartime conditions in England with respect to air raids and whatnot? Because this would be your first exposure to the war, quote unquote. How did you react to that?
You saw lots of signs of war in that city of Liverpool, in that port. There were two or three of the large battleships lying right there. They're much smaller than you would think. They, mm-hmm. beside a big troop ship like the Mauritania, a battleship just looks pretty close to the water.
Mm-hmm.
The crews on those ships, you know, and exchange talk with us and so on, but this Liverpool was a pretty grim-looking place. It was obviously had lots of signs of bombing.
Mm-hmm.
So then getting back to London, yes, that was a shock. It was very impressive. My first time I walked out, I walked across Berkeley Square. London in a blackout is very black.
Mm-hmm.
It is so black that sometimes you don't know where the curb is. You don't know when you've come to the end of a block. You sometimes might not know anywhere you were, where you were at all. But you could talk to anybody in that blackout, and they would help you out. They'd be friendly.
Mm-hmm.
the civilians would be friendly. If you got on a bus, they would be friendly and helpful. Of course, you went down in the tubes,
mm-hmm.
and in the tubes there were these hundreds of people sleeping in tiers, in bunks, all along the tube. Underground,
mm-hmm.
and that was all lit up, and that was one place that was well lighted. The anti-aircraft guns were manned and sitting in various corners, truly elaborate big guns. Heard my first air raid sirens. I made a trip out to one of those first nights out to visit relatives of my wife, and my first time that I talked to somebody living in London in wartime. They were living essentially in the kitchen and maybe one other room. The rest of the house wasn't livable. The doors didn't fit. The windows didn't fit. It couldn't be heated or. Not that anything was very much heated.
Mm-hmm.
It was the coldest place.
Altogether a different world from Fort McLeod.
Yeah.
We're getting into the fall of 1944 now, and do you find yourself at Lincoln Insfield, which was the RCAF overseas headquarters? You were at this time fitted out for a medical license, and posted to No. 6 Bomber Group. Which was predominantly RCAF. I'm just wondering what did getting a medical license in another country involve? After all, you're going to be practicing medicine in a foreign country. Were there any special problems or anything attached to getting a license?
No, I was surprised that one would require it, but you were bound by the non-military. We're bound by the ordinary licensing that would be required for any physician practicing.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a temporary license, but a big license with a big seal on it and my name on it and so on. We were given very little instruction. Otherwise, we were provided with our posting, provided with a train ticket and told generally where you were going, but nothing as to what it was.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just mentioned that No. 6 Bomber Group was essentially an RCAF outfit, and it was unique for its time because I believe it was one of the first attempts to Canadianize the war effort coming out of Britain, anyhow. And you actually lived and performed your medical duties at Allerton Park, which was I guess, for all intents and purposes, a castle nearby. Now, at that time, you must have had some contact with some fairly senior military officers in the RCAF, perhaps even in the Army and whatnot. I'm just wondering, what was the relationship like for you with such people? Were you accepted readily? I mean, by the military, the intelligence people. Tactics, etc. Were the medical people accepted no difficulty?
Accepted very well. I believe that the first evening I was there, the nursing sister told me to get ready to get over to the mess before the balloon goes up, which means the first bottle they put up at the. And there weren't too many bottles. There was only two or three put up in the mess for the night.
Mm-hmm.
So you went over there, and very quickly you met the very senior officers, ranks from flight lieutenants, but up to air vice marshals, air commodores, so on. So we met the officers there in the mess. There was a committee. commanding officer for even that station, which was rather a relatively small station, being a headquarters station.
Mm-hmm.
We were treated very well, and indeed almost any of those officers might have come to see me over in the sick quarters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now you remained at Allerton Park for a short time, and then in June 1945 you were in Leaming, England, which is also part of Number 6 Group. By the fall of that year, you were posted back to Lincoln Infield briefly as, I guess, the medical officer for the headquarters. Your rank at this time was still flight lieutenant, I believe, was it not?
Yes.
Yeah. Essentially, at Lincoln Infield, when you're on your second go-round, what was the nature of your duties here as the medical officer? Were you in charge of a certain staff and whatnot? And
This is where the RCAF, the main headquarters of the administration of the RCAF.
Mm-hmm.
It was a building of about four or five stories, one of the narrow London buildings. On various floors, there were various departments. I think the medical department was about the fourth or fifth floor. I was the only medical officer there. I had a small staff of, I did not have a nursing sister, but I had one or two NCOs and one or two airmen or airwomen. We had a little treatment area, and we had a sick parade area. I didn't have any infirmary or hospital there.
Mm-hmm.
You would see people from this headquarters unit again, and these ranks would be even higher than going from air marshal down to, I suppose there was an air marshal, but air vice marshal was common.
Mm-hmm.
All of these ranks in all of these various departments of the Air Force were present at this station.
So would your duties at Lincoln Infield, would they have varied considerably from those at Allerton Park, for instance? Or perhaps the responsibility?
At Allerton Park, it was operational. You could go into the, at Allerton Park, you could go into the operations room, you could see how many bombers were out tonight and where they were and so on. At Allerton Park, in the afternoon or evening, the sky would be black with bombers.
Mm-hmm.
Julie would be just filled with more airplanes than you could imagine. At Lincoln Infield, it was peacetime, and London was open, the lights were on, there was service people everywhere, service people coming and going, coming from the continent, coming from the Far East. So the management of people there was ordinary medical care.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have very much in the way of hospitals for the RCAF, really no hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
Other than our station or the hospitals on our bases. So commonly when people had particular problems, we would send them to Canadian Army hospitals in various parts of southern England.
Mm-hmm. I see. You stayed in Lincoln Infield on the second rotation there until 1946, summer of 1946, when you ultimately came home and were discharged. And just to get back to something we were talking about a little bit earlier, morale, I think, amongst a lot of the troops did sags with the end of the war, and many men were worried about what would happen to them in the post-war period as far as jobs and whatnot. Did you find, in the immediate post-war period, did you find you were dealing with a lot of these veterans who were having difficulties readjusting? Was that a primary concern for yourself and other people, other medical people?
You mean as they expected or looked forward to? Yes, the whole attitude had changed now.
Mm-hmm.
In the earlier times, in wartime, you talked military things. You talked about what was happening. Was there going to be any change? Were we going to be moved? Was the operation going to change? What about promotions? What about your whole life was that you thought about that service, about what would happen in that service, and how could I raise my rank or improve my position?
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't particularly so in the Air Force, in the Medical Corps, because most of us had the same rank, and most of us had it for the whole war.
Mm-hmm.
The squadron leaders, the wing commanders, the group captains, there perhaps there's only one or two in the service. They were people that had been in the service some time, or perhaps had been in peacetime service. So your rank didn't matter, but you did take a certain pride in your unit and what facilities you had and what you could scrounge or what you could particularly get to. If you could get some particular equipment for your station hospital or some particular facility, that's what your interest was.
Mm-hmm.
But now, as you thought of peacetime things, there was no more interest in the service. It was, when can I get home? When can I get repatriated?
Mm-hmm.
God, all those people are getting home. They're going to get all the jobs. They're going to get all the opportunities. Those people that are getting home now, but I'm going to be deprived of this.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a fact even in the medical area, that by the time I got back home, I was very interested in further medical training. But by this time, the hospitals, the residencies were filled everywhere in the United States and Canada, and there were no residencies open.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a very difficult time in getting training. And that the concern of people was very great that way. They now could damn the Air Force and damn the services and the Canadian government and Mackenzie King and whoever it was might be responsible for this. So the attitude had changed and the morale dropped remarkably.
Yeah. Of course, in your own case, you did eventually find a spot, and you wound up just a few years ago a very successful, I guess, 30-year career in primarily in Calgary.
Yes.
Well, Mr. McNeil, Dr. McNeil, I'd just like to say on behalf of myself and the History Department, thank you for taking time out to share your experiences with us.
My pleasure, Rick.
Thank you very much.